Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast sunny morning with Plain Gardening. We're going to talk a little bit more about your tomatoes. We're going to talk a lot more about spring. But Joe, Joe has called me and given me an opportunity to talk about one of my favorite things, which is trees, and particularly trees of the Black Belt of Alabama, which are really interesting. Joe, let me tell you, can I just say something? Joe and I have been talking about this mossy cup oak, and I think, Joe, there's a good chance that mossy cup oak came from one of these Black Belt populations of mossy cup oak, the oak that you're seeing in Bruton. The Black Belt Prairie was a prairie. It was across central Alabama. It had bison. It had, well, like most Alabama, it had two or three species of elephants. Oh, man, it breaks my heart. It
really?
Kills me.
Elephants?
Doesn't it kill you?
Yeah.
When people first came to Alabama, we had elephants. Well, they were called mastodons and mammoths and gamphotheres, but they were elephants. Very closely related to African elephants. Maybe even cooler. I think they're probably cooler than African elephants. We had 12-foot sloths. We had really cool stuff. And they were really concentrated in the Black Belt because the Black Belt had great prairies, great soil, great grasses that made great grassy prairies. But the Black Belt also had these weird oaks. And they're really unusual. One of those was this Black Belt population of mossy cup oak, which has these big, huge acorns that you got, and that they're just beautiful acorns. They're gigantic. Another famous one from the Black Belt is one I call Prairie Oak. It used to have a name called Durand Oak or Quercus sinuata. It's a beautiful white oak, really, really nice size acorns too. A beautiful thing. So, and a couple of other oaks that are basically almost endemic to the prairies, along with some hickories. There's some weird hickories called nutmeg hickory that you see growing up there with these trees. So the Black Belt has some really interesting trees in addition to being a prairie, and it's all because of that limestone, and it served as a refuge for these tree species. The limestone, Alabama has more patches of good limestone than almost any other eastern state. It's very interesting. And it's scattered throughout the state, certainly more than most southeastern states. And these limestone areas serve as refuges for certain types of plants. We don't know why they like the limestone so much. We could say it's calcium, but that doesn't make any sense. And I can give you good reasons for that. It's something else going on there. And I think it has to do with their vulnerability to diseases. So when you take them off the limestone in places like Alabama, where it's warm and where the diseases are prolific on our normally acid soils, like the acid soils we have around Bay Minette, yeah, different things could happen. We don't know. So here's what I'm saying, Joe, is, man, what a cool thing to have. Plant them. Here's another thing to say, Joe. You got to quit talking to me because you got to plant that acorn right away.
Oh, I'm listening to you.
You got to plant that acorn right away.
I built a building in Grove Hill, and it was a lime plant.
Say that again.
They had lime everywhere.
In Grove Hill, that's right.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on that one. That one drives me crazy. They killed one of the best prairies that ever existed in Clark County. And then decided they didn't like the lime. It's terrible. But there is in around Grove Hill in Monroe County, Salt Mountain, near Jackson, Alabama, up north of there. There's a streak of prairies running through there that are very interesting that run through the Red Hills. It's a little different in Bay Minette, but I think you should try it. And you got to plant the acorns as fast as you can, because acorns don't have a lot of viability. A few weeks. I mean, sometimes days or weeks after they hit the ground, they begin to lose viability. So you want to plant that acorn as quickly as you can so that it will germinate or it won't be good anymore.
I Googled it up, and you can actually buy the trees themselves, like two-footers.
That's right. You certainly can. And they're going to be from Illinois, and they're going to be from the Midwest. And you see what I'm saying? And
yeah.
I don't know that their genetics, you know, I don't know that their genetics are going to be what would be suitable down here. We think like people, you know. We think, well, human genetics are all the same. When we try to pretend they're different, but because people intermingle and they move around, but trees, they ain't got legs. So trees that are the same species in the Midwest don't have the same genetics as trees in the Black Belt. So they may be more naive to diseases. You can try them, but I think the Black Belt acorns are going to be better. So try to find some viable acorns from Alabama, from a tree in Alabama, and then give it a shot. That's going to be your best shot.
I got you.
But this is so exciting. I love mossy cup oak. I love these other great Black Belt oaks. And then it gives me one more chance to preach since it is Sunday morning.
Well, look, I got to get off the phone. I got to get these crawfish cooking, man.
Yeah, you need to do that. Get on them and work on that mossy cup oak and tell me about it.
All righty.
Joe, good to hear from you. Hey, listen, right. So this is very interesting. Alabama, can I repeat this one more time? Does anybody out there have memorized how many oak species there are in Alabama? You know what I'm going to say? Do I have to repeat it again? I'm going to say there's 39 species of oaks in Alabama, probably 40, but 39 for sure. 39 species of oaks native to Alabama. You couldn't name a tenth of them. Well, maybe. Maybe not a half, a quarter of them. And it takes a long time to figure out, because there's so many. It's one of the great centers of oak diversity. The center of oak diversity in North America, north of Mexico, is in Monroe County. No other place in the United States has more oak species than Monroe County and Clark County and Choctaw County, Alabama. Can you believe that? You should, because it's the truth. It's where oaks are concentrated is in Alabama. We have a lot of cool ones. And then we do crazy stuff because we don't understand where we are. We do crazy stuff like bringing in some silly, miserable, measly oak. This is no slight on Japan. Some weird Japanese oak that is perfect for Japan and has nothing to do with the Southeast, and everybody plants it. Thinking, oh, well, it's from Japan. It's got to be better than something from Alabama. Help me. Just help me understand this. Please help me understand this, because I don't understand it. You want precocious oaks. You want oaks that produce seeds early? I can give you a list of 10 of them, 15 of them from Alabama. And you're planting that miserable Japanese sawtooth oak. For deer, crazy. So that deer will have 2 weeks out of the year when they can eat acorns from this one miserable Japanese oak, when they're eating acorns from 20 species of oaks in Alabama on any hillside over a huge long season, over weeks and months. It's crazy. Any hunters out there who want to argue about this? I want to argue about it. It's craziness. And now the Japanese oaks are beginning to get off base. They're getting out. They're getting into other places. They're displacing our native oaks, which means our forests are poor for it. What are we doing? Oaks are really cool here. But I'm going to talk about tomatoes. We're going to be right back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, that's my punishment for going on and preaching, right? Yep. So, listen, I got a nut all oak is one of our native oaks. It's a great oak. What do we call it? Let's call it swamp red oak. It's quite common in it's. Well, we actually don't know how common it is. It's one of those oaks that tends to get overlooked, but it's a very prolific producer. It's a very good oak. It's good on any kind of soil. It's a great tree for downtown. It's nut all is a red oak. It's a member of the red oak group. And it's not in the white oak family if it's a nut all. It's red oak. Now, overcup, which is a nut which it grows with, overcup oak, which also has really big acorns. Really big acorns is a cool oak. And then cow oak grows with that. Michaud's oak. What else do we call it? Basket oak. Swamp chestnut oak. These trees grow together. Swamp chestnut, nut all. Swamp chestnut gets a little higher. Nut all oak, and then the which is a beautiful red oak. All of them are great for deer. Overcup oak, great for deer. All of them are great for growing in Mobile. We should be using these as street trees, and we need to be using them as street trees. And I was going to get into that today, but we won't have time. So Polecat asked me, it says, if you thought about getting Sean Sullivan on to talk about deer. Well, here's the problem. Yes, we talk about deer all the time. Yes, we argue about deer all the time. Yes, we argue about what to plant for deer and whether it makes any difference if you should plant anything at all. You know, the planting thing for deer is about commodities. It's about marketing. It's about people making money on selling you stuff to plant for deer. Ooh, I didn't say that out loud. I'm sorry I said that. But listen. Sean and I argue about it. The reason Sean and I don't get together on deer more is because that would interfere with something very important to Sean, which is his deer hunting. Sean works a lot, I'll have to say. He works a lot. He works a lot of hours. And he doesn't need another show. But we have talked about getting together and talking about hunting and deer. And because he knows if I come on, I'm going to make everybody mad because I'm going to say stuff like, I just said. So, just a word of warning, Polecat. Be down there picking out his new yacht. He may be today. That's right. He won't have time to ride in it though. That's the problem. Sean picking out his new yacht. Dan has. If somebody could organize my life, if I could get somebody to organize my life, it would be Dan because Dan never lets me forget that I'm supposed to talk about something. He reminds me again and again. And that's good, Dan, because, man, I got so many things going on, I can't remember everything. And Dan says, remember last week you asked about creatures that nurture the soil other than earthworms. This is pretty important. This is really important. Listen, here's a quick lesson in soil that you don't know. Soil is not just particles. Soil is a world. It is a universe of things. It's like New York City under the ground. Have you ever been to New York City? It's like, yeah, or where else? It's like Atlanta. It's like there are people, there are all sorts of people, and they're densely packed, more densely packed than they are in Atlanta. That's why New York City's a better thing. They're all just all in there, and they're all kind of things. It's not just earthworms. I mean, it's like bankers and lawyers and doctors and people who have shops and people who will cut your throat and people who have movie careers. They're all in there, in the soil. And they're all doing different things. And they're all really important to the soil. And the fact that all these creatures are in the soil is why plants can live there. The plants can't live with just dirt, ultimately. They really need these other creatures in the soil. And these other creatures actually help them get nutrients and help them get moisture and other things. It's very important. So I don't even know how to begin. Earthworms are the things we talk about because we can see earthworms and because we can go fishing with them. There's no other good reason to talk about earthworms as much as we do. They play an interesting role in the soil. It's not even a major one compared to what most other things do. But they're okay. It's good to have them. In some places with earthworms, actually the earthworms destroy the soil, and we can talk about why that happens. Earthworms have been introduced in places where they didn't occur, and they're beginning to destroy the soil there. But here's the – so what is under there? How do I describe all these things? Well, you've never heard of them because we don't talk about what's under there. But there are tons of microscopic things. One of the interesting things I just found out, Dan – is that there are these things called protists. We lump them together as protists, P-R-O-T-I-S-T-S. I told you these are not things, these are not terms we use. And amoeba is a type of protist. Amoeba, we use that because I think there's movies that have weird amoebas that take over the world. But amoebas are a type of protist. What's interesting, not the only protist, there are many others. What's interesting is that protists are very important in releasing nitrogen in the soil. And they do it because another really important group of soil creatures, which is very, very important, are bacteria. And there are all kinds of bacteria. I mean, there are probably tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of protists in your soil of different kinds. There's so many different kinds of bacteria. But these bacteria are in there. They're digesting little parts of things. And they produce an excess of nitrogen, and when the protists, which are predators, the tiger protists run around and they eat these little bacteria, which we can think of as sheep or cattle or whatever you want to think of them as. When the tigers eat those guys, it releases a ton of nitrogen. Isn't that weird? We think nitrogen comes from cows. Well, yeah. But no, it really comes from bacteria in the soil. And without cows, there's a whole manure cycle in the soil that's very complex. It's related to all these different soil creatures interacting. Fungi, fungus is very important in the soil. Bacteria are very important in the soil. Protists are very important in the soil. Springtails and other things that break down organic matter, they're all very important in the soil. I wish I were smart enough to remember all of the creatures that are in the soil, but there are tens of thousands of them. Here's the most important thing. We know this about those creatures. They need organic matter. They need dead stuff. They need leaves that are breaking down. That's what feeds them, and that's what feeds the plants. That's what feeds these soils. There you go. I'm glad you made me say that, Dan. Don't feel bad about it. Don't feel bad about it. How do we encourage the proper protists and bacteria in the soil? Just organic material. Organic material is the most important thing. There are you can get too many bacteria at sometimes if you have, let's don't get into that. Just organic material broadly, it will create a balance of bacteria, fungi, protists. All of that will work together, but you got to have the organic matter. Cow manure is a relatively unimportant source of that, just by the way. Leaves and wood and other things like that, much more important. That's it. Hey, Mary?
Yes?
Tell me what you're seeing.
I was able to get hold of a bunch of paper white bulbs recently.
Yeah.
And they are in a black plastic bag at the moment because I don't know if I should take off the flowers, put them in the refrigerator, plant them in the ground, plant them in a pot. What should I do with them?
Do not put them in the refrigerator. Put them in the ground immediately.
Put them in the ground.
Yeah. Did they come from the ground?
Yes.
Yep. So put them in the ground. It's not the best, just a word of warning. They do all of their photosynthesis in winter. So when you move them in winter, you interrupt that cycle, and that means they really struggle. You want to keep them as fresh and green as you possibly can if you want them to bloom next year.
Take all the foliage and flowers off?
No, absolutely not. Leave every bit of it on and hope that it survives. You need all – the only time they can replenish their bulbs is in December, January, and February and March because that's when they're green. So when the bulbs are – when the foliage dies, they can't replenish. So it's not the best time of year to move them now. It's better to wait until the foliage dies down with paper whites. That's going to happen in March. And then you can move them because then they've already gotten all their energy for the year. You see what I'm saying?
So by move them, you mean put them in a pot or something as opposed to the ground? Or?
No, what I'm saying is that it's better not to dig them this time of year. But they're dug.
Already dug.
So now you got to get them in the ground as fast as possible so that maybe they won't notice that you dug them at the wrong time of year.
And finally, could some of them go in pots or no, they all need to go in the ground?
I wouldn't put them in pots if, I mean, no, I don't think there's any advantage to putting them in pots. Certainly, if you want to put some in pots because you want to find a place for them later, I guess that's okay. It won't be a benefit to do that for the plants. It would be a benefit for you if you want to, if just in terms of organization, and you want to hold some out so you'll know where to put them later. But main thing is keep that foliage healthy, because that's how they're getting their energy. And if they'll survive, because bulbs are bulbs and they do have some energy stored, but they probably won't bloom next year.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So they'll come up, but they'll come up next year. Just make sure they have plenty of energy this fall, this winter. Give them as much as they can, because this is their big season of gaining energy, the big season of photosynthesis.
I remember reading somewhere where Martha Stewart agreed with you 100% keep the foliage on, but she would tie her foliage into bows so it didn't look so unattractive.
Right. Well, there was a yes, that's right. And there was a lady, I like to tell the story, and so now you get me to tell the story, so you'll have to listen to it. There's this lady that I live next door to Miss Killian, and Miss Killian lived next door to me in Anniston. And I was young, and I thought I knew too much. But I was always telling her, Miss Killian, you know, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do that. And she did it anyway, and it worked out just fine. And but she had bulbs stretching from her back door. She had this long lot that stretched from the top of Tyler Hill all the way back down to the little back down the ravine down Tyler Hill, this old hill in Anniston, all the way back down to the next block. And all along that long hill was a big row of bulbs. I mean, just thousands and thousands of bulbs. Incredible. All the way down the hill. I got to get to the point. But listen, every bulb, she went out and she tied a little knot in them, not a bow quite, but just a little knot, and laid them carefully down. And I said, Miss Killian, that's not particularly good for the bulbs, and it doesn't really help. And she said, that's the way my mother did it. That's the way I'm going to do it. So every year, Miss Killian died, and I miss her so much. Every year, I go out and at least one or two bulbs, I tie a little knot in them just to remember Miss Killian.
In her memory.
Yes. So I wouldn't recommend that you do that. But for a couple, just to remember Miss Killian and the fact that and you should do that.
Maybe Martha Stewart knew Miss Killian.
Maybe so.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, we got to take a break. We're going to take a break right now.
Wayfaring stranger. Traveling through this world alone, there is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which I go.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Oh, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Listen, what have I got to follow up on? Rusty Rusty is asking me whether in Moss Point, asking me whether I'm putting out my lime trees and blood oranges now. I'll confess to you, I do not have a lime tree. I think I wish I did. I did at one time. I don't anymore. Things happen. But I have blood oranges, and here's the interesting thing about the blood oranges. I left them out all winter. I just take Rusty for my blood oranges. What I do is I leave them in containers, and if it gets cold enough, I lay them down. It never got cold enough this year. I didn't even worry. So they're going to take, they'll take temperatures down to 26 degrees. I ain't going to think about it. I mean, that's fine. In fact, in Spain, where I see a lot of blood oranges are grown, kind of one of the places where blood oranges are most famous in southern Spain, I was there in the winter, and I can tell you that they would frequently get frosts and freezes down to about 20, 25, 26, 27 degrees. And the blood oranges did just fine. That's fine. They don't like temperatures in the lower 20s at all. Limes are more sensitive, but even with limes, I think I would probably try to leave them out most of the year and just lay them down. So, yes, I would bring them outside. And listen, Rusty, here's the thing to do. Because remember how we started the show. Springs are going to be less predictable now than they used to be, is my bet. Because of that, you always want to have a little bit extra protection. Bring them outside. It's time to do it. And when, if we get a late cold snap, I don't think it's going to get below 26 degrees. I don't think it's going to get below 26 degrees anymore. It could, but I doubt it. Just lay them down on the ground and cover them with a blanket. Makes a ton of difference. The ground will be plenty warm at this point. Plenty warm. Lay them down on the ground. Cover them with a blanket. The next morning when the temperature comes above 32 degrees, pull the blanket off. You're fine. You see what I'm saying? Pretty simple. Makes it a lot easier to manage these things. I don't know if you could do that with a lime during a really cold winter. Probably you could if you put it against the south or east side of your house. But there it is. That's what I'm thinking about. Hey, so my friend over at Wilmer, who's had great his nut all oak, he says, is a monster. After it grows. It's right. They grow very fast. They're great red oaks. They're really wonderful red oaks. They're beautiful. And they're neat. They're well adapted to our climate. They're native here. These nut all oaks, Quercus texana, I think is what we call it now. Quercus being the name for oak, texana. There ought to be a better name than nut all oak. Nut all was a guy who was, at any rate. Let's call them Delta red oaks. How is that? Let's give them the name Delta red oaks. Huh? Because they're quite common in the Delta. One of the more common high-quality red oaks of the Delta is the Delta red oak, Quercus texana. It's a great tree. So what's the difference between these Japanese trees and the American oaks? It's very interesting. Japan is a great place for plants. There's no question. I got 90% of your yard is Japanese plants at your house. There's no question. They're really cool, particularly for ornamentals. The Japanese know how to do gardens in a much more sophisticated way than we even ever imagined. It's why we have satsumas. Satsumas bring something to our gardens that we wouldn't have in North America otherwise because of the work that Japan did for years and years. That's important. So why is it different with the oaks? Well, Alabama oak diversity is much higher than Japanese oak diversity on any scale. We have a lot more to choose from, a lot more really cool oaks. That's one of the things. These oaks are highly adapted to conditions in the Southeast. The Japanese oaks are pretty well adapted, but not quite as well. There's another thing that's different between Japanese oaks in general, and I can't fully explain it. Between Japanese and Chinese oaks and American oaks. Japanese oaks are consistently, how do I describe it, limby. They have very low-hanging limbs. I don't know why that is. I think it has to do with fire and other things and how the forests were shaped here. But Japanese oaks tend to hold their limbs very, very low to the ground. They're stubby. They don't get very tall. Relative to American oaks, particularly the sawtooth oak. They hold their limbs very close to the ground. They're very limby. They have very dense limbs. That means nothing grows under them. They're the worst possible tree to plant in your yard because you're going to end up with a big bare spot underneath it, I promise. So this is how they grow. In the woods, that's not necessarily a good thing. That's not a good thing at all. Because it means that you've basically made a desert underneath that tree when these trees grow in the woods because nothing grows under them. Even with water oaks, even as limby and as messy as a water oak is, I mean, there's a little bit of light that penetrates that canopy. That doesn't happen with the sawtooth oaks at all. It's amazing how dense they are. So that's one of the big things is don't use those Japanese oaks in the woods. It doesn't make any sense. and it causes problems. It makes your woods less rich, less subject to deer. Johnny in Grand Bay has sent me a picture. Is that a Brazilian pepper, Johnny? That would be very unusual. I'm wondering if it's something else. I don't think it's Brazilian pepper. It would be unusual to have it here, but I'll look at it and think about it. That's weird. That's interesting. I haven't seen it before. Taxman.
Bill.
Yes, sir.
These knockout roses. I want to give a shout out to Thomas. He was really encouraging. So I'm going to do it. I'll be checking with Old Time Seed and Feed in Fairhope.
Yes, sir.
I think they're going to be having some.
Yeah,
I'm going to plant them in pure pine bark, okay?
I think that's going to work fine. Yeah.
And then these big, big, tremendous 5-gallon containers I got, and they'll get, I think, plenty of sun, but I'm very, very interested, and I'll keep you posted.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good text, man. Good, good. So, yeah, you know, there's an interesting thing about, and I think I decided I want to talk about this today because it's so dramatic. Bobby Green sent out a picture the other day. Bobby Green, the great nurseryman from Fairhope. And it was a picture of a crepe myrtle in Fairhope that somebody had trimmed off, but that's not the problem. The problem is that it was covered with this new crepe myrtle scale that's spreading everywhere. It was unbelievably ugly. I mean, if you haven't seen this crepe myrtle scale yet, you can't imagine what it will do to your crepe myrtle. It is unbelievable. And it is very hard to treat, extremely hard to treat, crepe myrtle scale. We're seeing it more and more. It's beginning to spread. It's a big problem. Boy, I hope it doesn't get in the woods, as Bobby says, and affect any of our native plants. But right now, it seems to be highly focused on crepe myrtles. Why is that? Well, we are Typhoid Marys. There's no question. People are Typhoid Marys. We bring diseases with us wherever we go because we're so dirty. We're so careless. We're so thoughtless about moving diseases around. And so we tend to create our own nightmares where plants are concerned. But here's the other thing we do. We create a condition in which every plant is exactly the same and everybody's planting exactly the same plant. Crepe myrtles was that way. We planted crepe myrtles everywhere. We planted them everywhere. So when we introduce a disease like the crepe myrtle scale, what happens? Every tree is suddenly, boom, it spreads like wildfire because there's not 3 feet before you run to another tree. It's happening now with the crepe myrtles. It happened with the dogwoods. People didn't pay attention. People said, oh, it's got to be Alabama power. I've heard so many excuses about the dogwoods. The fact of the matter of the dogwoods is we planted too many. That's the basic problem. We planted too many carelessly, and then we were Typhoid Marys, and we brought this stuff, and we moved it around. There it is. There was the basic problem. Now we're doing it with crepe myrtles. We're fixing to do the same thing with live oaks. It's happening with live oaks. Oh, man. And people are going to just say, oh, man, I didn't know. Be careful when you plant too much of the same thing. Over and over and over. The only thing I have, and the one thing I can only say about these roses is that we've now planted them. We'll be back.
If it keeps on raining, Libby's gonna break. If it keeps on raining, Libby's gonna break. Thank you.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. We don't have much time, so I want to get to these things very quickly because they're really important. Johnny. Johnny sent me a picture. Why did you think that was a Brazilian pepper, by the way?
My brother, I sent him a picture of it and said, look at this plant. It's real pretty. It looks like it's something you could use for a Christmas wreath. And he said, that looks like something I saw online. It's an invasive species in Florida. And I said, well, what is it called? He says, Brazilian pepper. So I looked it up, and it, you know, the one that I saw the first time 2 or 3 years ago was on one side of the road, and the other day I was walking on the road, and it was on the opposite side of the road, and there were dozens of them all around it.
So let me clarify real quickly. It is an invasive species, in fact. Yeah. It is not Brazilian pepper.
What is it?
It is, and I can sort of see how that confusion got there. They both have red berries. This is Artesia crenata. It's an Artesia. It's not an Anacardiaceae. If it were a Brazilian pepper, it would have these weird compound leaves. It would look more like a poison sumac tree, if you know what that looks like. But yeah. It is. It's actually a small shrub called Artesia crenata. That sometimes goes by the name Christmas berry because the berries are on at Christmas. That's confusing, yeah, as common names are, because there are a bunch of shrubs named Christmas berry. One of the plants called Christmas berry is Brazilian pepper. Right. So that's where the confusion possibly came from, too. But Artesia crenata, I'll think of another name for it. But it's Artesia. It's wild Artesia, and it is a big problem. It is beginning to spread in lots of areas. It is not as bad as Brazilian pepper by any stretch.
Well, the reason I called you was because the Brazilian pepper, there's a map, there's a national map showing where it's been reported, and Mobile County is one of the counties sitting here by itself where it has been reported. And I was like, you know, wondering if that was something that, you know, that we needed to look for,
so that,
and how to differentiate it.
Yep. So there's two things to think about. One, we should think about this Artesia, which people still cultivate, and it's not sold much in nurseries anymore, thank goodness. But it can be a problem, and it can be a real nuisance. So I would encourage you to get rid of those plants that you see there. So the Artesia is a problem in and of itself. There's no question.
Okay.
Brazilian pepper, the fact that Brazilian pepper is showing up in Mobile County could mean one of three things. One, it could mean that people misidentified it.
Yeah.
That's not hard to do, as you see. The second thing it could mean is that it's growing in somebody's yard, that somebody's cultivating it and carefully planting it there. And they would list it if that was the case. And it might have been just for a few years until it got too cold, because Brazilian pepper doesn't tolerate really cold temperatures. It would love this winter, but the previous two or three winters it would have been too cold. And the third thing it could mean is that it's really finally somehow established here. I don't think the third one is the likely one, because it is a little too cold for Brazilian pepper. We have plenty of other things we really need to look out for right now, and they're pretty serious. Kogon grass, of course, is one. Privet is another. Artesia is, privet is far worse than even Brazilian pepper. And it's already becoming a huge problem in southern Mobile County. It's all in those white cedar swamps. It's just really sad.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but I don't think Brazilian pepper is going to be a big problem. Artesia could be a minor problem, but significant, and it's probably worth getting rid of it.
I just didn't want to allow it to spread out if it was actually it, because apparently it's a time bomb that goes off after a long period of time when the canopy opens up.
That's right. It in Central Florida, it is almost as bad as privet. It is a serious issue in Central Florida. It's too cold for it here to become that kind of serious problem yet. as climate warms, we'll have to look for it more carefully. It just,
right.
We hadn't quite gotten there yet.
All right. Well, you allayed my fears a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I don't want to allay them too much. Get rid of that Artesia.
All right.
Hey, Johnny, good to hear from you, as always.
Thank you.
So a lot of flood questions from Dan this morning. I'm going to finish out the show by talking about peppers because it's a good time to talk about them. You need to be prepared for them. There are a number of kinds of peppers. There's the annuum peppers that are typical Mexican peppers, and that includes things like jalapenos and bell peppers and a whole bunch of others. Typical, they're well adapted to relatively dry climates like Mexico. They hate humidity in many cases. So we have a hard time with things like bell peppers sometimes. We have a really hard time with ancho poblanos. They often get little spots on the fruit here because it's just too humid. There are a number of South American peppers that are actually as good as or better than the Mexican annuum peppers. And they're in the group of peppers we call chinenses, which is a weird name, won't get into that, and bacatums. Dan, just quickly, and we'll have to come back and revisit this, chinenses include habaneros. So you got it reversed. The hottest of all tend to be the chinense peppers. They are very hot. And habaneros are included in that. However, there are some very, very mild chinenses as well that have almost no heat. And they're quite good. We grow some of those. They're really good. The bacatums, I love bacatums, are some of my favorite peppers. They're from Peru. The chinenses I think of as Caribbean peppers. The bacatums I think of as Peruvian peppers. I love the flavor of those. They are actually hardy enough to survive most winters here. It's amazing. Not every winter, but a lot of winters. They're really incredible peppers. They have great flavor. Their heat levels vary considerably. In general, I would describe them as not as hot as the hottest chinenses, but they can be very hot. They also can be very, very mild. And I have some that have almost no heat that people love. So there's a lot of variation. It's hard to generalize about heat because there's a lot of variation in heat in all of those groups of peppers, the annuums, the bacatums. Yeah. So, any rate, be thinking about that, the chinenses, the frutescens, which we won't have time to talk about because Charlie's giving me that signal that I got to go. But we're going to be back next week. Save your questions up. We'll do our best.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown